Talk Shoes. Recorded live.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James, along with Pastor William Fink, and another installment of the Christogenos Show. And this is our ongoing series on the book of Isaiah. I was unable to attend last Friday, so I thank Bill for filling in for me, and I understand he did about 7 or 8 chapters, but starting with chapter 8. But, and I'm sure we don't need to recap any of that, but I have a bunch of favorite verses that I've underlined in and circled in these various chapters of the book of Isaiah. And so I'm just going to go through these, and because they would have been ones I would have wanted to discuss at some length in any case, okay, had I been able to attend last Friday. So, Bill, before I get into Chapter 8, do you have any comments or synopsis or anything you want to discuss before this?
No, nothing. Okay. Nothing. I mean, I might feed off a little of what you discussed.
Sure,
I don't have anything.
Okay. All right, so in Chapter 8, I have verse 7 circled. Now, therefore, behold, Yahweh brings upon them the waters of the river, strong and many, even the king of Assyria and all his glory, and it shall come up over all its channels and go over all its banks. And the reason I have this circled is because of the water imagery, that waters represent people, certainly prophetically. Waters represent people. And the same imagery is used in the book of Revelation and probably in Daniel and many other places. So when you see waters mentioned in the book of Revelation, it's talking about people.
Rivers and trees.
Yes.
Yeah, and the sea. The sea, actually, too.
Right, exactly. The sea, rivers, and of course, the more often in the Old Testament, you have the tree imagery and wood imagery.
And also your metaphors for people.
Exactly. They're metaphors for people. And we have that tree imagery in Genesis chapter 3 as well, okay? And, in fact, we're going to see this very much, very, very soon, very specifically. Okay, and I have verse 13 circled. Sanctify Yahweh of hosts himself, and let him be your fear, and let him be your dread. We are to fear Yahweh only, okay? We are not to have any fear of any earthly element. And if we can train ourselves to fear Yahweh only, because he's our creator, folks. He is our creator. We don't fear anything else. As Paul put it, if God be with us, who can be against us? Okay? Chapter 9, verse 2. The people that walked in darkness have seen a great light. They that dwell in the land of the shadow of death, upon them has the light shine. Of course, he's talking about the Israelites. When Yahshua Messiah walked the earth, literally, do you recall?
Well, not only that, but this whole, I went into this at length last week.
Okay.
This entire passage is a double entendre.
Okay.
Galilee of the nations, actually, Galilee is a word that means circuit or region.
Right.
And the Sea of Kinnereth, or the Sea of Galilee, as it is called in New Testament times, is not beyond the Jordan. It's the source of the Jordan.
Right.
And I have a pamphlet on my site. I have an essay, Galilee of the Gentiles, with a question, asking a question, Galilee of the Gentiles?
Right.
And basically that same word that's translated beyond in Hebrew actually can also mean opposite. The sea opposite the Jordan.
Yeah.
Because we don't, when did Yahweh afflict Galilee? And there's not a whole lot about that in the Bible.
Yeah.
About Galilee. And there's a connection in Joshua chapter 9 to Galilee and the Tyrians.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, Tyre was on the mainland in Asher's territory, but it was also an island in the sea.
Okay,
and the
Testament
makes it clear that Zebulun would inherit the walled cities of the Tyrians and Tyre itself.
Mm-hmm.
And also a place called Kinnereth, which is the Sea of Kinnereth, what the Sea of Kinnereth is named for.
Right.
And that's what we know later is Galilee. But Zebulun in Genesis 49 is prophecy to live in a haven by the sea.
Mm-hmm.
And,
okay.
And if you look at Zebulun's territory, except for, you know, in the King James, Zebulun's territory doesn't border on any sea, except it's actually Naphtali that actually borders the Sea of Galilee.
Okay.
And Zebulun's stuck in the middle. And it's the Septuagint text that shows that Zebulun indeed inhabited the sea. And, mm-hmm. and I believe that this phrase here is a double entendre. It can be used to refer to Galilee, but it doesn't really fit.
Mm-hmm.
It really fits the region of the nations.
Okay.
That, yeah, you know, from the sea opposite the Jordan, but which is where the Tyre was and where Zebulun and Naphtali really traveled.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, even if Zebulun were sort of landlocked between the Mediterranean and the Sea of Galilee, they were still a seafaring tribe.
Okay. Well, right, and you only see that really in the Septuagint,
mm-hmm.
and in Genesis chapter 49.
Yes.
Now the Solomon gave Hiram 20 cities in Galilee, and Hiram didn't want them.
Okay.
He called them basically garbage. He called them Kabul,
yeah.
Which is a boundary or whatever.
Right.
But he's basically calling them garbage.
Yeah.
And then we go read 1 Chronicles 8:2. And we see that Hiram gave the cities back to Solomon, so Solomon rebuilt them and caused the children of Israel to live there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what does that tell you? That tells you that Zebulun wasn't living in the land of Zebulun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what it tells me.
Right. Well, yeah, because before, and of course, well, the only time that Galilee or this whole territory would have been afflicted between the time of the settlement by the Israelites and the various deportations would be just the Assyrian invasion. There would have been no other major invasion of this territory from my understanding of history. I don't know if you're aware of any other.
Right, and I believe that the Zebulunites never really dwelt there. They preferred Tyre and the
mm-hmm. yeah.
and the escape to Europe, basically.
Right. Well, the farmland would have been inhabited by Zebulunites and by Naphtalites, okay? But, yeah, being both seafaring tribes, well, most people understand Zebulun, modern Zebulun to be Holland, okay? They got in their boats and left because the Assyrians were invading, and they didn't want to be mowed down by the Assyrians.
Well, I believe that there was a long 600 years of colonization that the Bible doesn't really talk about.
Right.
But the records of Tyre and the ships of Tarshish and things like that.
Yes.
But we have these Phoenician colonies appearing all over the Mediterranean
mm-hmm.
while the children of Israel are in control
right.
of the so-called Phoenician cities.
Right, right. Yeah, and it's quite amazing to me that virtually every scholar admits that the Phoenician script and Hebrew script are identical, and yet they consider the Phoenicians and the Hebrews two entirely different people.
Right, and it can be demonstrated that before the Hebrews came in, before the conquest of Palestine by Joshua and the Israelites, the archaeology reveals that the primary script used in Palestine is cuneiform.
Okay.
That the Hebrew script doesn't really appear there until the Hebrews appear there.
Uh-huh. Right. Because Hebrew is much older than Phoenician. It's got to be at least 1,000 years older.
Right. But what I'm saying is that Hebrew is Phoenician.
Right. Yeah,
you know, and the people brought it in with them.
Yes. But virtually every scholar says that Hebrew is a form of Phoenician. It's the other way around.
Right, Phoenician, it's there shouldn't really be a distinction.
Right.
Because as far as I'm concerned, the Hebrews and Israelites, the Israelites were names for themselves.
Yeah.
Like we call the Germans, Germans.
Mm-hmm.
But Phoenician is the Greek name for the people of the coast, whether they be Israelites or even the Canaanites in
right.
later time.
It's a general territorial term, yes.
Right, the Greeks continued to call the inhabitants of the land, Phoenicia and Phoenicians, even long after the Israelites were, for the most part, taken away.
Right, right, yeah. So it's a territorial term. It's not a racial term, although the Israelites were probably the primary racial group that the Phoenicians consisted of.
Well, if you examine the Greek closely, you'll see that Phoenix is the word from which Phoenicia is truly derived, and that's the Greek grammar will prove that. And Phoenix means blood red.
Okay.
And Phoenix is basically Adamite in Greek. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Adamite is blood red, and
Phoenix
is blood red, and Phoenix is Phoenician. And
right.
And it's a translation of the word Adamite into Greek is exactly what it is.
The word Phoenician doesn't mean hook nose.
and they all try to say that the word phoenike comes from
dye. I know
from the word for purple.
Yeah.
The Greeks had a word for purple, and it was purpurus.
Okay.
All right. And
yeah.
And that the word phoenike eventually came to mean purple after the dye,
yeah.
But it's not the original word for purple,
okay.
Which is purpurus.
Very good, very good. Because, yeah, the mainstream scholars, being fooled by the Jews who claim to be the Hebrews, simply get this all confused because they had to reconstruct history in order to make the Jews Hebrews.
Well, they twist the entire Bible,
yes.
and all the ancient history in order to make the Jews Hebrews.
Right.
And to make the Jews Israelites.
Right. And
because if you realize that the Phoenicians are Aryans, and they were.
Yes.
I mean, the Phoenicians.
The Hebrews
of Carthage,
were Aryans. That's the point. Yes.
Well, right, it is. The Phoenicians of Carthage, the Phoenicians of Greece, seven against Thebes. Thebes in Greece was a Phoenician city, not a Dorian or a Danan city.
Yeah.
And that's an important distinction. The Phoenicians are the northern tribes of Israel, and they're described by the Greeks as having fair skin and blonde hair.
Mm-hmm.
And the Carthaginians are described by the Romans as having
fair skin
and
right.
blonde hair.
Right.
And
they're all Phoenicians.
Virgil calls Dido beautiful blonde Phoenician Dido.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that can't be a negress, that's for
right.
sure.
It can't be a hook-nosed kike either.
Well, right, it can't be a hook-nosed kike. And the whole, well, once the Phoenician question is answered, the fraud, the facade
right.
of the Jews cracks. It falls apart.
Right.
It
right.
crumbles.
Yeah, because I just recently got an email from the Australian guy who does the Bible Believers website, who's not quite identity. And somebody sent him an essay. I'll mention the guy's name, Roger Hathaway. Roger Hathaway sent him an essay in which he claimed that Yahweh is not the God of Israel, but the God of the Canaanites. Okay? And a long time ago, I sent Roger Hathaway all the proof that anyone could possibly need that Yahweh is the God of Israel, not the God of the Canaanites. The Canaanites had all kinds of gods, but Israel only has one God, and that's Yahweh, okay? So I tried to explain this to him, and he said, no, this is the Canaanite God. So I sent him a copy of the Septuagint that contained the old fragments of the Septuagint that have been found in Palestine.
Right, that's from the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yeah, from the Dead Sea
Scrolls. Fragments of the Greek that are after the Septuagint. I mean, it's the same Greek. But
mm-hmm.
wherever it says Kyrios, that we see the Hebrew Tetragrammaton instead.
Right. It's in Paleo-Hebrew, right to left. I sent him a copy of that, and he said, oh, well, that's Phoenician. Okay. Well, isn't Hebrew older than Phoenician?
It's very confusing. First, it's confusing because not enough ancient Hebrew or Phoenician texts have been found.
Mm-hmm.
We have very few texts compared to Greek and Roman, Greek
yeah.
and Latin, of course,
okay.
or other
yes.
languages even. Now, there were different shapes for some of the letters at different times,
mm-hmm.
okay, and in different places in Palestine. But it's still basically all Hebrew/Phoenician being it's still the same alphabet.
That's right.
It's the same basic alphabet. Some of the letters vary from time to time in place in various places.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still basically the same alphabet. I mean, if you draw a Q with a line through the circle on one side and I draw it on the other, it's still a Q. Yeah, you know, it's still a kappa, I should say, which was actually a Hebrew and an original Greek letter, but it fell into disuse as a Greek letter. That the Greek alphabet is basically the same alphabet, but that, you know, over years it became stylized and cleaned up and perfected. And that took 500-600 years to do that.
Uh-huh, right.
You know,
right.
And it's not everybody wrote the letters the same
yeah.
all the time everywhere. However, there are alphabets found on what's known to be school children's practice, that these clay fragments that they used from broken jars, they would reuse them to practice writing on. And they're called, I forget, I'm sorry. I forget okay. what they're called. I'm an idiot. Well anyway, yeah. that they're that these fragments with these alphabets written on it, they cannot be told apart from what we consider to be Phoenician.
Mm-hmm.
It's very clear that all the Paleo-Hebrew writing is,
yeah.
is basically Phoenician.
Yeah.
Anybody that tries to make a distinguishment is only making a fool of himself.
Right.
That
right.
there are enough of those inscriptions found to make that determination soundly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, anyway, Roger Hathaway refused to acknowledge this find, this archaeological find.
Well, he's obviously a vain man that would rather write
yeah.
history for us than
right.
examine what's written.
And the whole area, the Canaan land, Canaan was the son of Ham through incest by his mother, okay? So he had to have spoken Hebrew well before any Phoenicians did, right? And so did the Shemites speak Hebrew because they were brothers. Ham, Shem, and Japheth were all brothers, and they had to speak the same language.
It's certain that, Aramaic is very much like Hebrew, but not quite.
Okay.
And Chaldean, a lot of people don't know that the Chaldees are actually an Aramaic tribe
okay.
who conquered Babylon very late in the third millennium or very early in the second, right around the time of Abraham.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they probably already had it by Abraham, but it's argued among scholars if the original text said that Abraham came from Ur of the Chaldees, even though they don't doubt that he came from Ur.
Mm-hmm.
It's that all the Chaldees may have been added later. That's argued by scholars because it's not exactly clear
right.
when the Chaldees came from
mm-hmm.
the regions of Syria and conquered
right.
Babylon and took it over for themselves.
Yes. But Roger's obviously been influenced by the false teaching that Hebrew is derived from Phoenician, not the other way around. Okay, so he perceives falsely that Phoenician is an older language, which is possibly the Jews trying to push.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon?
That's what the Jews try to push.
Right.
They try to get us to believe that so that we think that they are a people other than
yes.
the Aryan type of Phoenicians
yeah.
that we know from history.
Yeah, yeah. And they're really the Canaanites that Canaan married into. he married into the Kenites, the various tribes of the Kenites. And when he did so, our people referred to that entire tribal grouping as Canaanites after Cain.
The alphabets of the Canaanites, before the Hebrews invaded Palestine, the alphabets of the Canaanites, first is Egyptian.
Yeah.
Egypt had a lot of political power in the land of Palestine and actually controlled much of it, even at the time of the Exodus.
Uh-huh.
And second is why Egypt acted against the children of Israel later was to try to get back what the children of Israel were conquering.
Right. Right.
Okay, and
so they had Egyptian hieroglyphs there before.
Right, and that happened. The Telarmana letters are all about appeals from the kings of the Canaanite city states
mm-hmm.
to the Egyptian pharaoh Akhenaten,
right.
who really wanted nothing to do with it. And they were appealing to him to come help them because the Abiru were invading and taking their cities.
Right,
and the pharaoh Akhenaten really he was caught up in his own little world, and he wanted nothing to do with it. So,
right.
so he didn't act, but subsequent pharaohs tried to regain part of that portion, part of that land for Egypt. And that
mm-hmm.
story is told later on in the Judges period.
Yes, yes. And it's also my understanding that the name, the Tetragrammaton, began to predominate in an old Canaan land when the Israelites began to take over. Okay. So, again, it proves that the Canaanites had all kinds of gods. But the Israelites, especially under Moses and Joshua, would have had Yahweh exclusively.
Well, right. And the primary language of the Canaanite inscriptions there were Egyptian inscriptions there, but the primary language of the inscriptions was cuneiform.
Okay.
The primary alphabet, I should say. I'm
right.
sorry.
Right,
and Hittite cuneiform. Hittite was written in cuneiform. There were places where the Chaldean was written in cuneiform, and there were places where Akkadian, of course, the language of the Assyrians was written in cuneiform.
Yeah.
Always was.
Right.
And the Clifton has a paper on his site, and it's under Who Is Your God?
Mm-hmm.
Under that section, under his papers. And that's just because the term Yah was found at Ebler and Ugarit is no sign that Yahweh is Canaanite in origin.
Right.
And he addresses that. And Ugarit was actually a Phoenician city.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
and I tend to believe that Ebla was actually a Hebrew city.
Okay.
And I don't know if I could prove it or not, but I have that in my mind for some reason.
Okay.
And Ebla was destroyed before 2000 BC.
I see.
But Ebla was it was in land that would have belonged to either Aram or Arphaxad, if we examine how the Shemitic lands were divided. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And we know Arphaxad is to the north of Aram.
Right.
And Akkad, or the land of the Assyrians, and they were Shemites too, was to the east.
Mm-hmm.
But Ebla, it's definitely in places related to the Hebrews. And I believe that the term Yah was probably around for a long time, that forms of the name Yahweh probably were around. Even though Yahweh said it wasn't revealed to the patriarchs,
right?
That meaning Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that it was first given to Moses, at the burning bush.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that the patriarchs before Abraham didn't have it.
Yeah.
And
question,
they very well may have.
Question in the chat room, does cuneiform predate Paleo-Hebrew? Well,
probably the inscriptions certainly do. The inscriptions certainly do. But Paleo-Hebrew, it's clear because of the similarities between Aramaic and Hebrew and Chaldean, which is a dialect of Aramaic.
Right.
They all must have had a common parent tongue and diverged from each other at an early time, just like American English and British English.
Okay. Well, here, there's a question also by David. Will you discuss Genesis 10:5 in relation to Genesis 11:1, if you want to flip over there real quick to find out what that's about, I'll go ahead and, because we're just discussing Isaiah 9, 1 and 2, I also want to discuss 6, 7 and 8. Let me just read those real quick. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder. Now, of course, that's a prophecy of the Messiah, Jesus Christ, Yahshua Messiah, and it's talking about the government. The government shall be on his shoulder. And the fact is, the vast majority of Judeo-Christian religion denies. They don't want the government. They just believe in, we're talking about earthly government here. We're not talking about pie in the sky by and by. This is talking about earthly government, and you can't have earthly government without the law. And his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace, verse 7, of the increase, again, of his government, and peace there shall be no end upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom to order it and to establish it with judgment and with justice from hereafter even forever. Now, this did not happen at the first coming. This is going to happen at the second coming, folks. The zeal of Yahweh's hosts will perform this. Yahweh sent a word into Jacob, and it has lighted upon Israel, exclusively Jacob Israel, no other people. Okay, did you get to Genesis 10?
I would like to discuss that for a minute.
Okay.
I would, there's a belief, and it's predominant, and it's people, it's not really a belief, it's like a concept, it's a conceptual problem.
Okay.
It's a concept that every verse in Genesis, it is laid out in some kind of chronological order.
Oh, okay.
And that's simply not true. I mean, Genesis 1, 27 and 28 and Genesis 2, 7, they're both talking about the same thing,
okay.
The creation of Adam. And it's talking about the creation of the same Adam in two different ways. Now, the same thing with Genesis 10 and Genesis 11. In Genesis 10, it's a table of nations, and it says from these, Genesis 10, 5, talking about the children of Japheth. From these, the islands of the nations divided in their land, each according to his tongue and their tribes and in their nations.
Mm-hmm.
Now Genesis 11:1 says the whole world was gathered together of one lip. Well, Genesis 10:5, Moses is writing this 2,000 years after it happened.
Yeah.
And he doesn't, it's not necessarily in chronological order. From these, the islands were divided. Well, when were they divided? Well, how about in the account of Genesis 11? That's mm-hmm. not a hard concept to grasp.
Okay. Well, I think people assume that the isles are literal islands, where isles can be interpreted as being territory.
Well yeah, but his question, you know, what he's trying to say from his question postulates that he perceives that there's a conflict here because Genesis 10:5 talks about the nations being divided,
okay.
each according to their tongues.
Right.
And 11:1 says the whole world, you know, the whole
okay.
family,
yeah, so,
or tribe or earth was gathered together of one tongue,
right.
one language to all. Well, Moses is writing 2,000 years after this happens.
Mm-hmm.
And if he says from these, you know, these nations were divided, and then he starts giving an account at 11:1,
yeah.
and he's basically saying that they were all together and then there was a division.
Right. So that's in other words,
you know, so that division in 10:5 happened in chapter 11. Yeah, you know, but it's not necessarily perfectly chronological. We have to take it as a unit.
Right. It could be mentioned as an afterthought by Moses, too, in verse 11:1. Okay.
Well, right, but 10 is only a table of nations and where they were derived from.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, it's not a chronological history as we believe, yeah, you know, as we perceive it to be.
Right, right.
And 11
right.
is the story of their separation.
Right. Yes, yes. Okay, very good. Yeah. So, yeah, so the theme has changed, and it's simply starting out by saying, well, at one time, the whole earth had one speech. Okay.
Well, right, and, mm-hmm. and where it says in Genesis 10:5 that the nations were divided, well, that chapter 11 describes that division.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it
right.
doesn't conflict with it.
Right.
And
right.
a Jew might think so, and I could see how people could be deceived into that, but the yeah. Bible is not
yeah,
a chronological history, as some people insist that it should be.
Right, yeah, and if it were, then that would be a conflict, but it isn't necessarily the case that it is, yeah. Okay, very good. Okay, let me get back here now to what was my next, I did 9 verses 6 through 8 while you were looking up those. Okay, so chapter 10, verses 20 through 23 I have circled here. And it shall come to pass in that day that the remnant of Israel and such as are escaped of the house of Jacob shall no more again stay upon him that smote them, but shall stay upon Yahweh, the Holy One of Israel. In truth, the remnant shall return, even the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God. Now, this is not talking about returning back to the land. It's returning to him.
Exactly.
Yes. Okay.
And the word means repent also.
Okay. Okay.
And that would be returning to Yahweh would be repentance.
Right. And it's only a remnant. It's not all Israel. It's only a remnant. Okay. Verse 22. For though your people Israel be as the sand of the sea, and our people did become as the sand of the sea, uncountable, millions, yet a remnant of them shall return. The consumption decreed shall overflow with righteousness. Okay. Among the remnant.
And this proves that Israel shall be spared because Yahweh has appointed, anointed Israel.
Yes.
And that, yeah, you know, that they shall not be destroyed because of the anointing,
mm-hmm.
that the yoke would be destroyed. And that shows that even after the deportation and the casting off of Israel, Israel is the only object of the scripture.
Right. And this is the physical. We're talking about physical Israel, not spiritual Israel. Okay. Now, chapter 11 is one of my favorites, and so I got a bunch of ones that I want to read, and I know you probably talked about several of these, but here, verse 1, and there shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots, and there's that wood imagery, okay, that tree imagery that is so common in Scripture, and that you cannot possibly say that trees, stems, roots, and branches can't mean people. And here we have one verse in which four words of wood imagery are used to represent Israel and, of course, the Messiah. Okay. Verse 4. But with righteousness shall he judge the poor and reprove with equity for the meek of the earth, and he shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth, and of course with truth. And with the breath of his lips shall he slay the wicked. Now this totally, totally reproves the modern notion that everybody will be forgiven. They will not be forgiven. There's no such language in the Bible at all, not even in the New Testament. Evil will be punished. It will not be forgiven, okay? The unrepentant will not be forgiven. Verse 5, and righteousness shall be the girdle of his loins, and faithfulness the girdle of his reins. The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and the little child shall lead them. This can only be after the second coming, after the judgment day has purged the earth of all the evil ones.
Well, I don't even know. It doesn't even mean that the wolf and the lion are going to be made sheep either.
Oh, right. No.
You know, right. And this, but there's a lot of Israel symbology here.
That's right.
The wolf could be Benjamin.
That's
and the
right.
calf, Ephraim, and... But I don't know what the leopard, you know, that
yes.
can't change his spots.
Well,
I
the leopard will run by.
I think that it really just means that these different types, that they're not necessarily our
mm-hmm.
well, our co-inheritors. They can't be.
Well, there will be peace, a general peace.
The enemy
the
will not be able to harm us.
Right.
Exactly.
There will be a general peace. After, because we just quoted the passages about his government being established, okay, after his government is established, because he's going to be ruling with a rod of iron, again, we have the same imagery in the book of Revelation, okay. Verse 7, and the cow and the bear shall feed, their young ones shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. There shall be a new order, and everything will be peaceful, okay. Verse 9, they shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. Praise Yahweh for that day. And in that day, verse 10, there shall be a root, there's that root again, of Jesse, which shall stand for an ensign of the people. To it shall the nation seek, and his rest shall be glorious. Not the Gentiles, because the Jews have redefined the word Gentile to mean non-Israelite, and that is a false definition. That's a totally false definition. That's so many people are confused by that. Verse 11, and it shall come to pass in that day that Yahweh shall set his hand again a second time to recover the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria. Okay? This is talking about the Assyrian captivity, recovering his people from the Assyrian captivity.
And which is why I don't think that the wolf and the leopard, that's talking about the second coming.
Right. Okay, well, it could certainly be talking about both. But
well, I really think it's talking about the fact that the children of Israel would survive their being scattered into
mm-hmm.
the nations of the Medes and the Assyrians
mm-hmm.
and the Persians and wherever they were scattered.
Yeah, well, very good. But verse 11, the whole point of verse 11 is that the word clearly says that the Israelites who were scattered by the Assyrian captivity will be recovered, okay? And, of course, the vast majority of your Judeo-Christian sects say, no, they disappeared. They can't be recovered.
And the whole theme of this chapter, the whole theme of this chapter is that Israel will be scattered amongst the wolf, the lion, the leopard, the
mm-hmm.
other nations.
That's right.
There were Hittites in Assyria.
Yes.
The Hittites had been folded into the Assyrian Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And they disappeared in ethnicity by then. But they were there in physical
right.
reality.
Yes.
And, you know, they disappeared as a national entity for the most part by that time.
Right.
But
no.
they still inhabited those lands. And we have many Adamic races and some, you know, some of the Mans are Kenite Hittite races.
Yeah.
But the children of Israel are to be scattered amongst these nations. And this chapter is one of those chapters guaranteeing that they will survive it and be regathered.
Right. And nobody but Christian Identity, and to some extent British Israel, they used to teach this, right?
Yeah,
but they
right.
seem to have abandoned this teaching. Okay? That the 10 lost tribes will be regathered, rediscovered, and brought back together. All 10 of them, and of course we know that under Sennacherib, the tribes of Judah and Benjamin were added to the 10, that all 12 tribes must survive. Absolutely must. Survive Otherwise, they can't be regathered. Okay? And then verse 16, and there shall be a highway for the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria, like as it was to Israel in the day that he came up out of the land of Egypt. Very, very important verse. This is probably the most important verse for the prophecy of the Assyrian captivity, predicting that we will escape through the Caucasus Mountains, the Dariel Pass, okay? And it's in Second Esdras. I didn't have time to look it up. But it talks about the great multitude of Israelites that went from Armenia through the Caucasus Mountains into Arsareth, okay, which is on the other side of the Caucasus Mountains, okay? So clearly it is predicting a second captivity and a second escape from captivity, and none of your Judeo-Christian denominations ever discuss this. In fact, they're clueless as to what this verse actually means, okay? This verse, ladies and gentlemen, tells us that the Israelites became the Caucasian people. That's what this verse is telling us, okay? Chapter 12, verse 2, behold, Elohim is my salvation. I will trust and not be afraid for Yahweh Yehovah. Now, wait a minute. I just caught this. Because Lord is in caps here, and Lord is a translation of, false translation of Yahweh, the Tetragrammaton. Does this verse have it twice? Yahweh?
No, it probably wouldn't, and I would bet, I'm going to check the Hebrew.
Yeah,
right
this,
now.
Because I have a different note here, but I just caught this. And I was, the reason I brought this verse up is because of the term salvation. And, you know, while you're looking that up, the Hebrew word for salvation, it's Strong's 3468 and 3444 primarily. In this verse, it's 3468. The most often it's 3444. Let me read the definitions of the word salvation from the Hebrew here. 3444, Yeshua. Sound like a familiar word? Yeshua, okay. From number 3467, I'll read that one too. Yasha. Something saved. For example, abstract deliverance. Hence, aid, victory, prosperity, deliverance, health, help, salvation, save, saving, welfare. Okay. Now, aside from the abstract definition, these are all very practical, literal terms for salvation. It's not talking about salvation after death or spiritual or saving souls. It's talking about the literal salvation of fleshly people. That's what it's talking about, okay? Number 3468, Yesha, liberty, deliverance, prosperity, safety, salvation, saving. It's not talking about saving souls. It's talking about saving people, literal people. 3467, Yasha, to be open, wide, or free, to be safe, free or succor, avenging, defend, deliver, preserve, rescue, be safe, bring or having salvation, save, savior, victory. These are all very practical terms, and very few of them have any spiritual post-mortem significance, right? Okay, that's the reason why I want to bring that up. What did you find? Does that verse have the word Yahweh twice?
Well, almost.
Almost?
I'm even looking at the Hebrew. Not that I read Hebrew, but I could make out, you know, I have a vocabulary and can make out a lot of characters.
Yeah.
And the Hebrew says Yahweh.
Really?
It says Yah. Which is the Yod and the Hey.
Okay.
You know, the first half of Yahweh. And then the next word is Yahweh.
Huh, interesting.
It says Yahweh. And they translated Yah as Lord and Yahweh as Jehovah.
Interesting.
As they do.
Yeah.
And that is odd to say.
That is very odd. So probably either maybe a word was lost in copying or something, because we are dealing with the Masoretic text here. the Masoretic Hebrew, okay, which has deleted a lot. And I would say that the Masoretic text is only, well, four-fifths as long as the Septuagint. So they deleted a lot of material. They may have lost a word here, okay, or maybe they duplicated a word here. For Yahweh, that's kind of strange, okay? But fascinating, very fascinating that it's twice. Okay.
Well, the Septuagint just drops one occurrence and writes curios.
Okay, really? It just drops one occurrence. Okay. Probably I would tend to go with the Septuagint there. So there's probably a copyist error in the
It could very well, there were no spaces between words in the original Hebrew.
Uh-huh, right.
Very well have been a scribe that wrote the first two letters and got interrupted or had a neuron snap.
And, yeah, right.
We've all done it.
Yeah.
And then wrote all four letters.
Yeah.
That's a possibility.
Yeah, it just doesn't make any sense there, you know, because that's a very strange translation. Thank you. Okay. All right. Chapter 13, verses 9, 10, and 11. Behold, the day of Yahweh come, cruel both with wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, and he shall destroy the sinners thereof out of it. Okay, again, confirmation that sinners will be destroyed. I don't know where these Judeo-Christians get this concept of love the sinner, hate the sin. It's nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. Verse 10, for the stars of heaven and the constellations thereof shall not give their light. The sun shall be darkened in its going forth, and the moon shall not cause their light to shine. There's going to be mayhem, folks. Absolute mayhem. Okay? Yahweh is not going to be happy with us at the second coming. And I will punish the world for their evil and the wicked for their iniquity, and I will cause the arrogancy of the proud to cease and will lay low the haughtiness of the terrible. He's not going to forgive these people. He does not forgive those who are not willing to repent. That's the bottom line. Any denomination that teaches otherwise is lying to you. Verse 22, and the wild beasts of the islands shall cry in their desolate houses, and dragons in their pleasant palaces, and her time is near to come, and her days shall not be prolonged. Okay? The reason I circled this one, I thought that beast was translated from Che here, but it's translated from a different word entirely. But the dragons here is interesting. What's your take on this word dragon? Is it referring to some kind of extinct animal of some kind?
I'm sorry, which verse is it?
This is 13:22. And the wild beasts of the islands shall cry in their desolate houses, because these beasts live in houses, according to this verse. But it's the beast is not Che. It's translated from a different word. I forget what it is now.
Dragons is it's the Hebrew word tanim, which is a dragon or a sea monster or a serpent or a venomous snake, and these are metaphors for people.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
These words are being used idiomatically for people. I mean, satyrs shall dance there.
Yes,
and that's I can
right in verse 21.
It can pretty well be shown that. That I had a paper I got to expound on one night, and it's the name of the paper. It's one of the first papers I ever wrote, and I never sent it to Clifton.
Oh, okay.
And it says Esau is the first satyr.
Okay.
And,
interesting.
it basically makes a connection with the Canaanites and the satyr myth.
Right. The mixed breed hybridization experiments that were going on in those days. Yeah.
Well, right, because the satyr was half goat, half man.
Right. Right,
in Greek mythology,
yeah,
and the whole pan thing, and that I believe that all comes from Esau.
Yeah, okay. I just lost my place. Okay, chapter 14, verses 12 through 17. How are you fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How are you cut down to the ground, which did weaken the nations? And of course, the word Lucifer means light bearer. Okay,
Anybody in opposition to Yahweh can set themselves up as the light bearer. I mean, look at what the Jews have done today.
Right. They claim to be the bearers of the Old Testament, right?
Right. And the old, it's the ancient kings, and this is obviously the case with this king of Babylon that's
right.
spoken about here. The ancient kings, the pharaohs, considered themselves to be the sun on earth.
Yes.
that they considered themselves to be the chief god on earth and the sun, and light emanated from them, and they were the light bearers. And it was true basically of the Romans and the Roman Caesars and of many other kings, and obviously it's true here of the Babylonians.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And of course, what's true of ancient Babylon is also true of mystery Babylon in the book of Revelation, because these verses are true of both. Okay, verse 13, I'm going to just read 13 through 17. For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. This applies to mystery Babylon too. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. Of course, they're trying to establish a one-world religion. Yeah, the Pope too.
And the stars of God are basically the Adamic race and the children of Israel. I mean,
right.
That's symbology is used of them often.
Well, right, because Satan / Lucifer understood that the Adamites were here, sent here to displace him, okay? And his whole program is to try to prevent that from happening, right? Verse 14, I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. And indeed, they have become like the Most High to the vast majority of our people. They worshiped a Jew instead of Yahweh and Yahshua. Verse 15, yet you shall be brought down to hell, to the sides of the pit, that they see you shall narrowly look upon you and consider you, saying, is this the man that made the earth to tremble and did shake the kingdoms? This little 4'9" banker sitting at his desk pushing a pencil, this is the Antichrist. This is the devil. This is the person we're all afraid of. Verse 17, that made the world as a wilderness and destroyed the cities thereof, that opened not the house of his prisoners. Okay? The world is in fear and terror of this little Jewish banker. Okay? Because he controls the money, he controls the military and the economy and the government. And people worship him as if he were God. That's the literal reality, folks. But, of course, they've been deceived into swallowing this baloney that the Jews are God's chosen people and therefore have the exclusive right to interpret Scripture. It's garbage. It's garbage. Okay, so those are the verses that I underlined. Where did you leave off?
Well, I read through chapter 16.
Through chapter 16? Okay. All right, so let me just continue then. Chapter 17, verse 1. The burden of Damascus. Behold, Damascus is taken away from being a city, and it shall be a ruinous heap. Okay? The cities of Aroer are forsaken. They shall be for flocks, which shall lie down, and none shall make them afraid. So these cities will be destroyed and turned into grazing land. Verse 3. The fortress also shall cease from Ephraim, and the kingdom from Damascus, and the remnant of Syria. Was Damascus a part of the territory of Ephraim?
No, it wasn't. And it's obvious that there were many Ephraimites in Syria at the time. I mean, the children of Israel during the kingdom years greatly overspilled their boundaries, the original boundaries that they had.
Yes.
And actually, Aram, you know, first they were a kindred nation to the Hebrews. And set, you know, Yahweh
right.
actually sent his prophets into Damascus to anoint kings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's clear. It's right. There's one instance of it right in explicitly in the book of Kings.
Okay.
That Yahweh sent one of the prophets, I think it was Elisha, into Damascus to anoint Hazael or Rezin or one of those Syrian men to be the king of Syria.
Right, right. So, well, we have Aroer. We have this connection to the word Arian, Aram, Aroer, Arian, okay? And, of course, the word Arian means the noble ones. And,
let me give a historical citation. Strabo,
okay.
There was a group, there was a tribe of the Syrians called White Syrians.
Okay.
That were also called Cappadocians in later times.
Uh-huh, okay.
And the name Cappadocia is not an ancient name. And Strabo said that he couldn't understand why they called them white Syrians.
As if all Syrians were white.
and he says, as if there were any black ones.
Right.
Which basically means that all Syrians were white.
Right.
I mean, there's no doubt.
Yes, yes. Well, they didn't get their suntan. That's why. And isn't it one of the words that's translated as dark in the Old Testament? I think in the Song of Solomon, it really means tanned.
Well, because, yes, and that's what the word Ethiopian really means.
Right.
Is sunburned face.
Right, exactly. Thank you. Okay. And then it goes on to, verse 3 goes on to say, they shall be as the glory of the children of Israel, says Yahweh of hosts. And this must be tongue-in-cheek here. And in that day it shall come to pass that the glory of Jacob shall be made thin, right? That's why it has to be tongue-in-cheek, because we've been discussing the glory of Israel waning and being taken from them as captives and now outcasts. And the fatness of his flesh shall wax lean.
Well, let me say one more thing about this. Fortress shall also cease from Ephraim. And that's
okay.
That Ephraim and Aram had a league against Judah.
Oh, okay.
In the years before that Isaiah had wrote this.
Yeah.
If 2 weeks ago when we started Isaiah, I had elucidated that, Ephraim and Aram, that Isaiah began his prophecy right around the time that the northern tribes made a league with the Syrians against Judah.
Mm-hmm.
In 2 Kings chapters 13 and 15.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's right around the time Isaiah started writing.
Yes, very good, very good. Okay, verse 5. And it shall be as when the harvestman gathers the corn and reaps the ears with his arm, and it shall be as he that gathers ears in the valley of Rephaim. Oh, boy. Rephaim are fallen angel people. Yet gleaning,
yes, they are.
Yeah. Oh, now, this is a very famous verse, at least in British Israel. Let me read it here. Yet gleaning grapes shall be left in it as the shaking of an olive tree, 2 or 3 berries in the top of the uppermost bough, 4 or 5 in the outmost fruitful branches thereof, says Yahweh of Israel, Yahweh Elohim of Israel. The 2 or 3 berries have been interpreted by British Israelite scholars as tea teffy.
I think you might be referring to Ezekiel chapter 17.
Oh, was that Ezekiel 17?
And that's where it talks about it talks explicitly about the household of the king being destroyed.
Okay.
Except that the twig from the uppermost branch will be clipped off and taken away.
Right. Would this be an oblique reference to that?
Well, this is talking about Syria.
Syria.
It's clear that this is talking about Syria, and it's just
referring
to some good Syrians will be left in the land.
Oh, okay. And 4 or 5 in the outmost fruitful branches thereof.
And let me, just as a side note, say that Damascus, they love to call Rome the eternal city. But by all accounts, Rome wasn't founded until 750 B.C.
Right.
Well, Damascus is actually
older.
Mentioned in Genesis at the time of Abraham.
Right.
And it's still there today.
That's right.
And it's been continually inhabited.
Yes, it says Damascus is taken away from being a city, but it doesn't say forever.
And it says that 2 or 3 berries and some of the side branches will be left.
That's right. Very good. Okay. Verse 7. At that day shall a man look to his maker, and his eyes shall have respect to the Holy One of Israel. Now, how often do we have to hear this expression, Holy One of Israel, to know that Yahweh... Before we understand it, Yahweh is the Holy One of Israel, and he is our God, and we are not to have any other gods. I mean, the Old Testament is just full of these references to Yahweh and Israel being exclusively his people.
And it never says that he's the Holy One of the Hutus and Tutsis.
That's right. Or the Jews. It says Israel. Verse 8, and he shall not look to the altars, the work of his hands, neither shall respect that which his fingers have made, either the groves or the images. Now, of course, this is a reference to the idol worship and, of course, the paganization that had gone on among the Israelites in these former days. In that day shall his strong cities be as a forsaken bough and an uppermost branch which they left because of the children of Israel, and there shall be desolation. So I think we can gather from these verses that the Aramites would travel with the Israelites, and, because they are, in fact, our kinsmen. And probably.
Well, right, and that's why Deuteronomy 23:7 should really say, thou shalt not abhor an Aramean, for he is thy brother.
Right, exactly.
Yes. And here, you know, Yahweh tells the people of Damascus, thou hast forgotten the God of thy salvation.
Yes, yes, and thanks to Clifton for noting that scribal error. I think we found another one here in this earlier verse where Yahweh appears, okay? Verse 10, because you have forgotten the God of your salvation. There's that word salvation again, and it's talking about the literal salvation of the people. It's not talking about spiritual salvation, and have not been mindful of the rock of your strength, which is Yahweh. Therefore shall you plant pleasant plants and shall set it with strange slips.
Which tells me that there'll be some race mixing going
on. That's right.
And we have Damascus today is it is a sewer.
Right.
It's a genetic sewer. It's a genetic cesspool.
Right. Right. Verse 11. In the day shall you make your plant to grow, and in the morning shall you make your seed to flourish. But the harvest shall be a heap in the day of grief and of desperate sorrow, as you just explained. Verse
That's 12. The day of Yahweh's judgment on the nations.
Yeah.
I mean, the oracle is really to Damascus, but it's saying that the people are going to be taken away
mm-hmm.
set with strange slips, and at the end of days, it's going to be a, you know, nothing. There's nothing but goats there.
Right, and it's going to be a heap, and a heap can be taken as a mass of different types of people, okay? Verse 12, woe to the multitude of many people which make a noise like the noise of the seas, and to the rushing of nations that make a rushing like the rushing of mighty waters. I think we're experiencing this today. This right now, the Middle East is in utter turmoil. I mean, the Arabs are fighting amongst themselves. The Muslims have just as many denominations probably as the Christians do. Fighting amongst themselves, fighting against others, fighting against Palestinians, against the Syrians, against the Arabs. Okay, they're all fighting amongst themselves and fighting against the Jews. It's total chaos over there. Verse 13: the nations shall rush like the rushing of many waters, but God shall rebuke them, and they shall flee far off, and shall be chased as the chaff of the mountains before the wind. And like a rolling thing before the whirlwind. And behold, at evening trouble, and before the morning he is not. This is the portion of them that spoil us, and the lot of them that rob us. Of course, us being Israelites. Okay? So, folks, the prophecy for that area of the world is not very good. Of course, it's not the prophecies for the entire planet are not very good come the second coming, the judgment day. Okay? And, I was just thinking about this whole situation today. This verse obviously is talking about the situation in the Middle East and among the Arab peoples and that mixed race bunch of people over there. The fact is that their religions, even if you want to call it religion in the singular, you got Buddhism, you got Hinduism, you got Jainism, you got Muslim. Islam, and they have the same problem that we do. Namely, they have priesthoods that are utterly corrupt, exploiting their own people and teaching a bunch of rot in the name of whatever documents that they use for the foundation of their religion. Of course, we have the same problem here in Christianity. They all have the same Bible. But they all teach doctrines that can't be found in the Bible. The entire world of religion on this whole planet has the same disease. Namely, the priesthoods are all corrupt and all out to exploit the people for their self-serving purposes. Unfortunately, that's the sad state of religion today. Okay? You cannot trust religion to a professional priesthood. Okay? And I think Paul, more than any other teacher, explains this very thoroughly And, of course, there's references made to in the book of Revelation as well, namely the Nicolaitanes, the professional priests. You cannot trust.
Well, right. And if you look at the church, the writings, all the writings of the earliest Christian writers, I don't want to say Jerome, but I know Tertullian, Irenaeus, Justin Martyr, all of the anti-Nicene writers, the writers in Christianity from the period before the Council of Nicaea.
Right.
There's no such word, there's no such phrase as Christian priest in any of their writing.
Okay.
You'll only find that phrase from the Council of Nicaea forward.
Right. Right.
The corruption of Christianity with the professional priesthood,
right. So, and I mean, this just struck me today that Islam has the same problem. They have professional priests of various denominations, and they're just as much responsible for the infighting among their own people as, you know, we are Protestant, Catholic, lukewarm, right?
Well, right. But you know something? Let me say something.
Okay.
If the imams of Islam taught the people what the Quran really said, and that was revealed to us, then we would not have these our lands full of these bastards.
Right.
Because we would know enough that they want nothing but to kill us and subjugate us, and we would keep them out. If the imams taught the truth, we wouldn't be deceived by them.
Right.
They're not teaching the truth, and we're being deceived by them. And the Jews are lying to us about what that religion's all about.
Yeah, they're not our friends.
But when you hear about extremist Muslims, they're the Muslims that are probably teaching what the Quran says.
Right.
And they're considered extremists. Well, they are extremists to us.
Yes.
They're extremely opposed to us.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth of the Quran is it is a corrupt, perverted book which seeks to destroy Christianity.
Right.
Again, it's Judaism for non-Jews.
Right.
And for non-whites.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Jews, Satan wants to use the non-whites to destroy the white race.
Right.
And the Quran's the religion by which he chose to do it.
Yeah, and it's and for those who don't know the history of the Quran, the fact is that Muhammad was illiterate, and he had to hire people to write it for him, and it turned out he hired some rabbis. Okay, he literally hired some rabbis who basically lifted a bunch of verses from the Old Testament and then made up a bunch of new verses, shuffled it all together, and popped out as the Quran. Okay.
The Quran is a really perverted piece of work. I mean, I peruse them from time to time just for entertainment purposes. But it has conversations in it between Christ and the apostles, wholly contrived conversations. The apostles are saying to Christ, yes, master, we will be good Muslims, and we will do this, and we will do that.
Right.
And this, they recognize Jesus, but not as the Son of God. They just recognize him as a prophet. Well, they pervert the entire gospel.
Sure.
And they seek to destroy Christianity, and they seek to destroy our race. And every Muslim imam has it, especially the ones that the Negroes that have been converted to Islam,
yes,
every one of them wants to destroy the white man. Every single one of them, without a doubt, seeks to do nothing but destroy the white man.
Was that your experience with them in the joint?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So it was militant Islam.
They're all militant. They're all extremely militant.
Yes. Yeah, well, Malcolm X was extremely anti-white, although I think he eventually caught on to the Jews. I don't know whether he could.
Well, I mean, the Nation of Islam Negroes, they know all about the Jews.
Yeah,
They they know there's a book written by one of those Negroes if one of them could possibly write a book, right? I think he hired a Jew to write it.
Right.
And a Jew will do anything for money. But there's a book written by the Nation of Islam.
His own mother, right?
And it's called The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews. And it tells the entire story.
It's a great book.
About the Jews and the slave trade.
Yeah.
And that's a part of that book, but it tells that story. The American Negro, the Nation of Islam Negro, they know that the Jews ran the slave trade, and that their situation is basically the Jews are responsible for it. They
understand all of that.
They still hate the white man.
Yes.
They still, and even though they know what the Jews are up to, they still play the patsies for the Jews against the white man.
That's right. Well, Farrakhan, you know, here in Chicago, he talks about that all the time. You know, he openly castigates the Jews for the evil they do. However, his group rents out the University of Illinois, Chicago campus, big hall. It's a huge hall, right? And there's never any demonstrations when they rent that hall. I wonder why.
Well, no. And you know, there's on Christogene here, I got a poster of the Black Power Conference.
Okay.
On my site. And let me bring it up because I want to, you know, first I have a video from a Negro so-called college professor from some college.
Right.
And he is basically saying that the white man has to die.
Yeah.
The white man has to be eliminated from the planet.
Sure.
Okay?
Yep.
And then after that, I have a video from another Negro who was a Muslim Negro leader in the 70s. And his name is Khalid Muhammad, and he calls himself Doctor, but he's
right.
Absolutely arrogant. Well, I have this video from him saying that the white men have to be exterminated.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
And this is on
the
Consider
those,
link.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the Consider link at Christogene.
Yeah.
And then I have a Black Power Conference poster from 2009. And I showed a whole poster, and it has a picture of this Negro professor that said all the white men have to die.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a picture of this Negro Muslim that says all the white men have to die that were in these videos.
Yeah.
They are, in fact, it's dedicated to the Negro Muslim.
Yeah.
In the video that I have that says all white men have
right.
to die.
Right.
And there's also pictures of Michelle and Barack Obama on the poster.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And many other Negro figures.
Yeah.
And
they're Muslims, too.
Are militant racists who openly, publicly proclaim that all white men have to die.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't hear nothing about this from the ADL.
Right.
Or from the Antifa, the anti-fascist movement.
Or the mainstream press, right?
Or the mainstream press. We don't hear anything of this.
Right. That's right.
And this is—it's right out in the open. It's open.
It is.
It's in plain sight.
It's out in the open, and the Jews—you know—you think with all the anti-Semitic rhetoric that they get away with, you think some Jew would complain, but you never hear any Jews complaining about what when they say things like, you know, because they will say what we say about the Jews, okay, but they don't get raked over the coals, and they don't get articles written about them that they're right-wing terrorists, homegrown terrorists or anything like that, okay, because they're black. Right, kill the white people, yes, and that's what they advocate. But because they advocate killing white people, the mainstream press and the Jews don't complain, okay, which tells me that the whole thing is orchestrated, okay?
Of course it's orchestrated.
Yeah. David made the earlier comment that the Quran is a mini Talmud. That's right. That's what it is.
It's like the Talmud for dummies.
Yeah, right, for black people. The Talmud
for
black people. Yeah. Yeah, and then we have the Professor Ignatieff at Harvard say, oh, white people have to die. We have to eliminate the white race. Why aren't these people being accused of racism and hate speech? They're not being accused. Only white people are accused. Okay, wanted to get that off my chest. Thank you.
Well, that's the way it is.
That's right.
Only
that's
white
the way
people.
It is.
In the eyes of the Jew, only the white man is capable of hate.
That's right.
And the Jew is the author of hate.
That's right. That's absolutely right. He's got hate down to a science, and he always blames that he always projects it on other people.
Well, the goal of every action of the Jew is to destroy the creation of Yahweh.
That's right.
And that's right from the beginning. Right from the Garden of Eden,
mm-hmm.
and from before that even.
Right.
That was the ancestors of the Jews rebelling against Yahweh then,
mm-hmm.
and it's the Jews rebelling against Yahweh today.
Right. And fortunately, our people outproduced the Jews, or always have outproduced the Jews, and for a while.
Well, not today, because we're playing the Jews.
Right.
today we're playing a job. I mean, most men are sleeping with men.
That's right. That's right. So they've got, but through brainwashing, they have gotten our race to commit racial suicide. But fortunately, there's a remnant who refuse to do that, and they will never be able to kill a remnant. Okay, chapter 18, verse 1. Woe to the land shadowing with wings, which is beyond the rivers of Ethiopia.
Now, let me say something about this, because Swift and Comparé interpreted this as meaning America.
Oh. Okay.
And that's just not possible.
Mm-hmm.
It's just ridiculous. And basically, the land shadow, and let me read Zephaniah 3:10,
okay,
talking about the dispersed of Israel. From beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, my suppliants, even the daughter of my dispersed, shall bring mine offering. And if we understand Zephaniah when he was writing, we can understand that the people that dwelt beyond the rivers of Asiatic Cush.
Okay.
Because that's what this is talking about. And that's how there's a river in Ethiopia in the Garden of Eden, because that points to Asiatic Cush.
Okay.
The word is Cush, and there were two Cushes.
Right.
One in Asia and one in
Egypt.
Yeah, you know, below Egypt.
Right.
And this is the ancient the first Babylonian Empire was actually the Empire of Cush. And Kush extended all the way to the Indus River, where we have the Hindu Kush Mountains today.
Right.
To this day. The land beyond the rivers of Asiatic Kush are the Jakarta's River and the northern India, and that's where a major part, not the entire dispersion of Israel, but a major part of the dispersion of Israel,
right,
the Saka and the Massagete, dwelt there for many years before they actually decided to pick up and migrate towards Europe.
Right.
Which didn't culminate until the 5th century B.C. A.D. I'm sorry, A.D.
Right, right. Okay. So would this include the Aryans, those of our ancestors that went as far as the Indus River as well?
Well, yes. That's the way I look at this verse and
these
passages here and in Zephaniah 3:10.
Okay, very good. All right, verse 2. That sends ambassadors by the sea, even in vessels of bulrushes upon the water, saying, go, you swift messengers, to a nation scattered and peeled, to a people terrible from their beginning until now, a nation meted out and trodden down, whose land the rivers have spoiled.
Okay. Now this can only mean the children of Israel.
Yeah.
And the rivers of the Assyrians and the other ally nations that destroyed that land.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then, now if we're sending ambassadors by sea, the quickest route to those two rivers, one is the Indus. What was the one that was closer? What was the name of that river again?
Well, the Tigris and the Euphrates and the Indus River.
Yeah, there was one in between on this side of the Indus River. There were like two valleys. The Indus Valley was one, and there was one closer to Mesopotamia. I forget the name of that river.
Nope, sorry, you got me.
Right. But anyway, that's the territory of the Aryans. Okay. In fact, both of those rivers.
Well, that land was actually called Ariana in Roman times. On Roman era maps.
Right, right. And there's the Aramaeans.
And that's where we get the word Iran from.
Right, right. And so, though anybody traveling to that territory would have gone by sea because it was so much quicker, because the only other route was the Silk Road. Okay, from Mesopotamia. You either went by sea down the river, you know, down the Tigris or Euphrates, and then up the Indus, or you took the Silk Road. And the Silk Road would take a lot longer, and I guess you could run into pirates in either case, you know, but you're much safer going by boat, and it was much quicker, too.
Well, rivers were the ancient highways,
that's
no
right.
doubt.
That's right. Okay. Verse 3. All you inhabitants of the world and dwellers on the earth, see you when He lifts up an ensign on the mountains, and when he blows a trumpet, hear you. Okay, now, isn't this suggestive of the fact that when the Aryan world, you know, and of course, much of the non-Israelite Aryan world understood what was happening to the Israelites because they were our kinsmen, okay? And when the Messiah had come, they heard about it and understood what it was all about. Isn't that the case? It's not just the Israelites.
I would say that was true to a great degree.
Mm-hmm.
The Parthians.
Yes.
Actually, at the time of Christ, Israelite tribes controlled the known world.
That's right.
The Parthians in the east, and the Romans in the west, and the Scythians in the north.
Okay. Yeah.
However, there were a lot of Japhethite and Hamitic people living within those bounds.
That's right.
Yeah, you know, the Parthians came to rule over many Japhethite and Shemite non-Israelite tribes.
Right.
The Romans ruled over many Japhethite non-Israelite tribes.
Yes. And then the Genesis 10, I think, says, or it's either 10 or 6, that Japheth shall dwell in the tents of Shem.
Well, right, and that's in the end of Genesis chapter 9, actually.
Okay.
But, right, and that's, I believe that that's fulfilled mostly in the Slavic inhabitants of Europe.
Right.
However, a lot of those Slavs are really Scythians, and a lot of the people that we perceive as Germanic are really Slavs. The lines aren't that as clear as we'd like to think they
right.
are.
Right, right.
Yeah, and a clear instance is the Wends.
Mm-hmm.
That they settled in historic times. Otto, the Saxon king, drove them out of Saxony, and they settled around Brandenburg in East Germany.
Okay.
And that's, you know, today that's East Germany, and all those people are considered German, but they're Slavs.
Mm-hmm.
They're descended from the Slavic tribe of the Wends.
Right, yeah. Yeah, Germany, there's a heavy mixture between Shemitic Germans and Slavic Japhethites.
Well, right, but Japheth is definitely dwelling in the tents of Shem. There's no doubt.
Yes, that's right.
The Tartesians of Iberia, the Pelasgians of the Alps, the Thracians of the Danube Valleys,
yes.
they're definitely here with us.
And there's nothing wrong with that because they're of our race and we're allowed to intermarry them with them. It's just that the patriarchal tribes are always traced through the father. You know, of course, we would have difficulty tracing that today. Okay, but
well,
Yahweh
right.
knows.
And today, there's another thing I would a couple other caveats I would issue, and that's that you know, even though Japhethite Adamites dwelt in a lot of those places at one time, today they're actually to a good degree there's a great number of Arabs and Turks and other people to look out for that.
Yeah.
Well, we don't want a mistake for those people.
That's right. That's right. Okay, very good. Verse 4. For so Yahweh said to me, I will take my rest and I will consider in my dwelling place like a clear heat upon herbs and like a cloud of dew in the heat of the harvest. So it sounds to me that he's looking forward to the day of judgment here. Any other interpretation from you here on verse 4?
No, it's, I don't know, it's a little enigmatic. I think
yes,
the translation
it is, sort
is
of
not
a,
very clear. I'm sorry.
Yeah. But,
it almost sounds like it could be talking about something positive.
Well, that is positive. The judgment day is positive for the remnant. Yes, okay. Verse 5, before the harvest, when the bud is perfect, and the sour grape is ripening in the flower, he shall both cut off the sprigs with pruning hooks and take away and cut down the branches. So, in other words, he's talking about planting good twigs, or what do you call it?
Pruning.
Yeah, a pruning. You cut off a branch and stick it in the ground, and it grows, right? Verse 6. They shall be left together to the fowls of the mountains and to the beasts of the earth, okay? And the fowls shall summer upon them, and all the beasts of the earth shall, the other races will sit upon us, take advantage of us. In that time shall the present be brought to Yahweh of hosts of a people scattered and peeled, and from a people terrible from their beginning until now, a nation meted out and trodden underfoot, whose land the rivers have spoiled, to the place of the name of Yahweh of hosts, the Mount Zion. Okay, so obviously the...
Well, in my purview, you know, the other nations have been feasting at our expense.
That's right.
Ever since we were driven off from Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
And especially
in
these last few hundred years.
Right. Yes, certainly. Certainly in the last 100 years when the Rothschilds began exterminating our people from World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and onwards, and our people simply don't understand that we're prey. we have become prey, and the Jews have brainwashed us into giving up our dominion and allowing the people of the earth, the other peoples of the earth, to walk all over us. In fact, there's a great, let me just turn to it, because it caught my eye when I was reading the Revised Standard Version, Isaiah 51, I believe it is. The very last verse, I think it is, 20, yes. Let me read verses, because we only have a few minutes left. There's no point in starting chapter 19, which is a long chapter. But here's what Yahweh says to our people. Let me start with verse 21. Therefore, hear now this, you afflicted and drunken, but not with wine. Okay? Our people are afflicted and drunk with false doctrine. That's what we're drunk with. We're drunk with the Judeo-Christianity, the dispensationalism, the rapture theory, the God loves everybody nonsense. We're totally drunk with this nonsense. Okay, verse 22. Thus says your Adonai, Yahweh, and your Elohim, that pleads the cause of his people. Behold, I have taken out of your hand the cup of trembling, even the dregs of the cup of my fury. You shall no more drink it again. Okay, so what he's saying here, it's not in his hand anymore. He's putting it in the hand of somebody else. But I will put it into the hand of them that afflict you, which have said to your soul, bow down, that we may go over. And you have laid your body as the ground and as the street to them that went over. Now, this is talking about our people, our wimpy white Israelites.
Basically being whores for everybody else.
Yeah, and being a doormat. Being a doormat for the Jews. That's what this verse is telling us. This can't be about the Jews. Have the Jews ever allowed themselves to be a doormat for anybody else?
They'd have you right in court real quick.
That's right. It ain't happening to the Jews. That verse cannot possibly be about, it's about the wimpy white Christian who has been taught by his pulpit bastard that he must love everybody in spite of how evil they are and take all the abuse that they give him, because if you take their abuse, they will be converted to Christianity. That's what they're being taught. That's what the white South Africans were being taught by their pulpit bastards in Southern Africa. Now look what's happening to them today. They're being butchered and murdered and robbed and raped by the people to whom they have been so generous and kind that they gave everything they had to those people, and now those people have turned around like dogs and are butchering them.
And this, it'll happen here, too.
It's going to happen
here.
I mean,
it is happening here. It's happening here, but it's not hitting the newspapers.
Right.
I mean, 100 white women a day are being raped by Negroes.
That's right.
There are most of the robberies and most of the burglaries that Negroes commit are committed against whites.
That's right.
And we don't see it, but when you add it up on a national scale, I mean, we've been under attack for
mm-hmm.
40 years,
yeah.
And we're too stupid to figure it out.
That's right.
And the average white person says, oh, they're okay.
Yeah.
They're no different from us.
Right, right.
Well, I never in my life witnessed a white man breaking into a Negro's house.
Right.
I've never witnessed a white man robbing a Negro's business.
Right.
I've never witnessed a white man robbing a Negro's business. I mean, it may have happened somewhere at some time,
yeah.
But I spent 12 years in law enforcement, 12 years in prison, and 30 years on the streets of Jersey City.
Mm-hmm.
I never saw it.
Yeah, yeah. So we can see the fruit of this modern gospel of race mixing is nothing but death and destruction for our people. That's all it is. And I'm sorry, yeah, and people in the chat room are saying it's stupid white people. That's right. It's stupid white people who are so, and you know, part of it is obviously they've been deceived by their pulpit bastards, you know, who are nothing but whores for the Jews, okay? But they're stroking their egos. That's the real problem. It's arrogance, because what these white, stupid white Christians have been telling themselves is that look how good I am to these blacks. Look how good I am to these Indians. Look how good I am to these Mexicans. And they stroke their own egos by telling themselves this garbage, okay? Now they're reaping the results of their own arrogance, because that's what it is. It's arrogance. It's self-flattery. That's what it is. But they flatter themselves unto their own demise, because what they're doing is they're giving up their Yahweh-given dominion. Genesis chapter 1, folks. Yahweh gave us the dominion, and if we give it away, we will be punished for it.
Well, the only time I ever agree with a Jew that I know of is when Savage said that Savage came up with the punchline that liberalism was a mental disorder.
That's right.
It's really a mental disease. Our people,
yeah.
And it's in, Savage doesn't tell you the truth about it, though.
Right.
It's inflicted by the Jew.
That's right.
The
absolutely
Jew has
right.
inflicted us with the mental disease of liberalism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
And white people, instead of paying attention to reality, they're caught up in the Jew media, the Jew newspapers,
right.
and the Jew-purchased pulpit whores. Well,
yeah.
they're totally oblivious to what's really
right.
going
well,
on.
Yeah, and yeah, the liberals have exactly the same disease as the Judeo-Christians. They flatter themselves constantly by saying, oh, we're such good white people, we give everything we have to the other races. And they flatter, they actually think they're doing the right thing.
Well, that's the major, I mean, it's not a very big blog, but the theme of the blog at Christogenia is the mental disease of liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
The destruction that it's caused us.
Right, right. And
white liberal misogyny,
yeah.
which is hatred of race, and,
right.
and contrasted to the agenda of non-whites.
Right. So it's finally getting to the point where some of these stupid white people are beginning to wake up and realize that this give everything you can to the other races policy is not working.
Well, you know, for all of my life's experience tells me that the other races have never really hidden their agenda from us.
No, they haven't.
The Negroes want to destroy us.
That's right.
And the Mexicans are here to loot and
yeah.
pillage and take what they perceive to be their land back
right.
from us.
Well, there was a time when all the other races feared the white man. And the Bible says the other races will fear us.
And when we give up our God.
That's right.
And the government became our God.
That's right.
But the government's not
the
protecting
Jew.
Us from the other races.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Because we have abandoned Yahweh. Yahweh has abandoned us. And he told us 100 times, if not more, in the Old Testament and in the New, that if we abandon him, he will treat us likewise.
And that's why the only way we have out of this mess is repentance.
That's right.
And once we turn back to our God and he accepts us back,
right.
then 5 of us will chase 100 again.
That's right. But these Judeo-Christians, they have abandoned the entire concept of repentance because they believe that what they're doing is so good, you can't get any better than they are.
Well,
right?
Well, they're doormats. And in prison lingo, the only thing Isaiah forgot to include in this verse is the Vaseline.
Yeah, right. That's right. That's right. So liberals and Judeo-Christians are just, they're basically left-wing and right-wing versions of the same stupidity. Give everything you have away to the other races so they can love you and that the world will be, you know, the heavenly, on, heaven on earth, according to materialism, not according to Yahweh. Okay? So folks, what's happening to our people in South Africa today, what's happening to Americans and Brits and Europeans at the hands of the invasion from the other countries, from the other races, it's genocide. It's a war. And our people don't comprehend that they're being attacked and they're inviting them in.
It's incredible.
There's no word for it. It's so incredible.
And it's not only, it's one giant psyop also.
Right.
Because we have so many white males that are homosexuals and so many white females that are sleeping with other women
mm-hmm.
that are lesbian.
Other races,
it's incredible.
Yes. Yes.
And all of those people are not making babies.
That's right.
And then the people that are correctly sexually oriented,
mm-hmm.
that they're so vain and so caught up in themselves that most of those women are on birth control and they don't want children either.
Right, right. Yeah, and that, you're talking Europe. and the
well, right, but it's in all of the metropolitan areas here also. The same attitude prevails.
Right. JB in the chat room used the word spew. He's going to spew those liars and haters out of his mouth. Yes, thank you very much. That's right.
Oh, yes, he is.
And Joel says blacks get as much welfare money as whites, and we are three times more numerous. That's right. And they commit most of the crime, if not all of it. The blue-collar crime, I guess you would call it. The Jews commit the white-collar crime. Okay. But Yahweh is spewing out his anger in Iceland, isn't he?
Well, I heard there was a lot. I just heard this about an hour before the program, that there was a huge earthquake in China. What's up with that?
Yeah, there was an earthquake in China. There was one. There have been several.
There have been a lot of large ones, you know, down in Southern California near the Mexican border.
Right.
I had a map that there was a 7 and a few smaller ones. And then thousands of real small, you know, aftershocks.
Yeah.
But I heard there was a very large one in China. Was that near an urban center or was?
No, it was in western China. Four to 600 people killed and many thousands wounded. They're still counting. They're still counting.
Right. Western China is not very heavily populated.
Right. It's sparsely populated. But the it's not really a volcano. It is a volcano, but it's primarily ash. The cloud of ash is disrupting Europe's air service. Britain, France, Norway, Sweden, many countries, they can't have air service because of this cloud of ash. So
right,
they have no idea how long it's going to last.
Yesterday.
Yeah. So Yahweh is getting angry, and he's spewing out his wrath. Okay. And just because, as we've been pointing, Europe has abandoned, and before the show started, we talked about the problems in British Israel, that they seem to have abandoned the racial message, okay? You know, they have given up their birthright and by inviting the Jews in. That's what they've done.
Well, I mean, the Europeans gave it up long before we did.
That's right.
I think that was just historical circumstances. It doesn't lend any credence to our piety, that's for sure.
Right, no, because we're next. We're next, and it's happening right here, too. But at least because we have the Second Amendment, there's going to be some resistance here, okay? But guess 39, I'm primarily German. My parents came from the Heidelberg area, right between the Rhine and Danube. I just can't believe how our people are simply giving up their identity. I just can't believe it. You know, it just boggles my mind. But anyway, you know, the awakening is occurring. The only way this awakening is occurring is through pain, because they refuse to listen to the Bible. They refuse to listen to the warnings. And, you know, the right-wingers in America have been warning us about this for 50, 60, 70 years, that there's a Jewish agenda behind all this, and it's going to fail. It's going to fall apart. Now we're seeing it. Okay. All right. Very good. So tomorrow I won't be around, so I'll let the...
Well, tomorrow I'm going to do something a little different. I'm going to read at least a good part of Tertullian's De Spectaculis about spectacles.
Okay.
And I'm going to do that to illustrate that the attendance at sporting events and all this idolatry that's going on today is just that. It's idolatry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. That's absolutely right. Because it puts Yahweh in second place. Okay. All right. So we'll continue this discussion next Friday. And then Sunday, I'm going to have Skip Baker. And he and I are going to be talking about the Seventh-day Adventist Church and all of the false doctrine that's coming from that group, okay? So thank you all for tuning in this evening. Praise Yahweh, and keep the faith, folks. Be true to your race. Yahweh bless everybody.